It's Tuesday, December 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the United Nations moves to monitor civilian evacuations from Aleppo.
He shot him behind the podium, she said. The assailant was saying, Allah Akbar.
A Russian ambassador is gunned down in Turkey. Also ahead, India and Pakistan relations as the year ends. And a pop star meets the incoming commander-in-chief. It's all on today's International Edition. The United Nations Security Council has voted on a draft resolution to deploy UN monitors to the devastated Syrian city of Aleppo as thousands of civilians in the formerly rebel-held eastern sector evacuate. Meeting late Sunday with reporters, U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Power called for a sizable deployment.
Everyone knows that the bigger the better, the more monitors the better, because they can be in more places.
So it's left to the Secretary General to decide?
Or it's left to the Secretary General to mobilize as many UN personnel as he can. I believe his plan, because this is an urgent, real-time, immediate issue, is to repurpose people who are in Aleppo already. The resolution also calls for those personnel to be supplemented by whatever staff is necessary. Look, if this were to actually work, which nothing in Syria, you know, really has for the civilians of Syria, so we all have to take this with a grain of salt, you would see the rapid procession of people who want to leave out with monitors on the buses, monitors at the checkpoints as they cross into, if they're crossing into Western Aleppo, or if they're crossing over to Idlib. And that is something that could be done with a combination of ICRC, Syrian Arab Red Crescent, and UN personnel on the ground, at least to make things much better than it is now. So we don't have weeks. People are hungry. They're starving. They're freezing.
Hundreds of civilians were able to leave Aleppo as part of a Russia-Turkey arrangement with the Syrian government that allows civilians trapped in two northwest towns besieged by rebels to depart. VOA's Jamie Detmer tells International Edition host Ira Melman more about the UN monitors to Syria, as well as the overall situation in Aleppo and what might lie ahead.
Well, it's significant to actually have an agreement by the Russians. They haven't vetoed this. It's coming a bit, late in the day. We think there are only about another 16,000 civilians left in eastern Aleppo. A deal that was brokered last night has seen already 50 buses taking evacuees out, another 50 going in. So a lot are already out. I mean, obviously, however, it would be good news if there was monitoring on the ground to what happens to the remaining 15, 16,000 civilians, maybe 5,000 fighters. But the big question is, are they going to be allowed in once they arrive on the borders of Aleppo City? We've seen often agreements by the Syrian government with the UN to allow aid convoys in, for example, and then it all gets held up.
So what happens now? Who are the opposing forces here? There seems to be, obviously, there's the Syrian army. There are Russian troops fighting with them. But what kind of factions are making up the other side? And where do they stand?
Well, there are lots of different factions on both sides involved. I mean, on the government side, as well as the Russians, you have Iranian Revolutionary Guards. You have Hezbollah from Lebanon. And a lot of these negotiations are being very complex because you have to negotiate not just, say, with Damascus or Moscow, but with the Iranians and Lebanese Shia and Iraq Shia as well, for example. On the other side, mainly around Aleppo, inside Aleppo, you have more moderate, pragmatic rebel groups. But you have had, until recently, quite a few hundred Al-Qaeda-linked fighters there as well, although they're all out now. I mean, on both sides, you have tremendous divisions and not necessarily central control.
Now, if there is any kind of a lasting peace, and I guess by lasting we mean over 24 hours in Aleppo, this doesn't mean the whole war in Syria is over. Is that correct?
Certainly not, no. What you're now going to see is everything turning towards the neighboring province of Aleppo, Idlib, which is the largest chunk of territory the rebels still control. Russian warplanes have already been bombing it. Those evacuees from Aleppo are actually going to Idlib. So you have a very large population in Idlib already from NATO civilian. Now you've got the Aleppo civilians there as well. And what many military tacticians think is happening is that Damascus and Moscow is preparing Idlib to be what is technically called a kill box. That's where you encourage all your enemies to go. So you have them all in one place, ready to be wiped out virtually. And that's what the great fear is, that what we've just seen in Aleppo is going to be repeated in Idlib.
VOA's Jamie Detmer. Well, it has been quite an active news day, and much of it not good. Time for our daily social media report. Michael Lippin is here with news of reaction to several violent incidents in Europe that many people are calling terrorism.
That's right, Jim. It's been quite a grim day in Europe, with violent attacks in the German capital Berlin, the Turkish capital Ankara, and Switzerland's largest city Zurich. In Berlin, authorities say unidentified assailants slammed a truck into a popular outdoor Christmas market crowded with people, killing at least 9 and wounding more than 50 others, based on latest reports. In Ankara, we had an extraordinary deadly shooting inside an art gallery where an off-duty Turkish security officer with a gun assassinated Russia's ambassador to Turkey while the ambassador was giving a speech in front of a group of reporters and other people, and those images have been spread widely on social media. And also in Zurich, authorities said an unidentified gunman shot and wounded 3 men inside a mosque while the men were praying before the gunman fled the scene. Now back to the deadliest of those incidents. In Berlin, one of the top daily newspapers in Berlin, the Berliner Morgenpost, got attention on Facebook for streaming a live video from the scene of that Christmas market minutes after the truck plowed through it. In that video, you can see many people walking around in confusion, some people on the ground, debris everywhere. And as I was reading through the comments on that live stream, translated from German to English, I saw many people criticize the German reporter for actually walking through the market rather than stopping to help wounded people. Hmm. And then there were other Facebook users saying, no, let the reporter do his job and show people what's going on.
Wow, amazing reactions to social media and live streaming. And in fact, we'll talk more about the Russia ambassador a little bit later in the program. What kind of Twitter reaction have you seen to today's events?
Well, hashtag PrayForBerlin is one of the top Twitter world trends right now. We've seen similar hashtags following other tragic terrorist attacks in other cities in the past year. But that hashtag is getting some pushback. Melanie Murphy, an Irish YouTube video star, said this, "I'm done with pray for hashtags. We need real-life compassion instead of killing, education and strength instead of violence. Act." And then we had a tweet that I saw from a Russian-French journalist with Radio France International, Elena Servitaz. She summarized the feelings of many people about this day when she wrote, "I want this horrible day to be over. Hashtag Berlin, hashtag Zurich, hashtag Ankara." And then she added hashtag Aleppo, just reminding everyone that there is a tragic situation unfolding in the Syrian city, too.
Jim. Quite a bit. Well, thank you so much for that analysis, Michael. Follow him on Twitter as well, at Michael_Lippin. I'm there at VOA Stevenson. And our international edition stream is at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, China and United States readying for tougher rivalry in disputed Asian Sea, ASEAN to play bigger role in Rohingya crisis, President Park associate makes appearance in South Korean court, Human Rights Watch says Indian police killings go unpunished, Vietnam factories turn waste into art. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, take the news with you. Download our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. As we heard just a moment ago from Michael Lippin in our social media segment in the Turkish capital Ankara, the Russian ambassador was shot dead by a reported Turkish policeman while attending the opening of an exhibition. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the assassination is being linked to Syria.
The shooting of the Russian ambassador, Andrei Karlov, was captured by video cameras recording his speech opening an exhibition in a gallery in the heart of Ankara. As the ambassador was speaking, a gunman approached the podium and opened fire, shooting Karlov 4 to 5 times. 3 other people were also injured. One witness explains that Syria appears to be the motivation for the attack. He shot him behind the podium, she said. The assailant was saying, Allah Akbar. He mentioned that Russia was killing innocent people in Aleppo and in Syria. He said it will not be let go without a revenge. According to another witness, the gunman also shouted, do not forget Aleppo, do not forget Syria. As long as our lands are not safe, you will not be safe. The ambassador was rushed to a hospital, but local news agencies reported that he was pronounced dead soon after arriving. Security forces shot dead the gunman in the gallery, identified by Ankara Mayor Meli Gökçek as a 22-year-old police officer. It remains unclear if the police officer was on duty. Some reports claim the Russian ambassador did not have his own personal protection. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has spoken with Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to brief him on the assassination. The shooting comes as the two countries are in the midst of rapprochement efforts following last year's downing by Turkish jets of a Russian bomber operating in Syria. The two countries have been collaborating on resolving the refugee crisis in Aleppo. Turkish official sources say a meeting of Turkish, Russian and Iranian foreign ministers scheduled for Tuesday will still take place. The meeting is for discussions on Aleppo and wider efforts to end the Syrian civil war. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And of course, there's much more to the story. We spoke with Dorian Jones later about the broader impact of this shooting amid several other events in Turkey.
Turkey's in the space of a week has been the victim of two major suicide bombings over the weekend. Suicide bomber attacked in soldiers in the provincial city of Kayseri. Here in Istanbul, Saturday before, a football stadium was the target of suicide bomber, targeting police that were on duty there. There's been a wave of attacks. Also, Islamic State has been very active. In fact, in this year, over 300 people have now died in suicide bombings, be it from the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, or the Islamic State. So Turkey is at the center of a series of conflicts on its regions within the country, and this latest attack will only add to a great deal of instability and fear that the country is slowly sliding into more chaos and more violence.
Dorian Jones for VOA in Istanbul. And as these developments continue to evolve, turn to our website at voanews.com for the latest. Relations between India and Pakistan significantly deteriorated this year. The rising tensions worry the global community since the two neighbors have fought several wars in the past and are now nuclear armed. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more from Islamabad.
The year started with a promise for improved relations. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi had paid a surprise visit last December to attend the wedding of Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's granddaughter. The dramatic visit was supposed to warm relations that had been frosty for months. But that effort was soon thwarted by an attack in January on an Indian airbase in Pathankot, 50 kilometers from the Pakistani border. Pakistan-based Kashmiri militants took responsibility, and from that point onwards, the relationship went steadily downhill. In July, a young firebrand Kashmiri separatist leader was gunned down by Indian forces. Burhan Wani's death sparked widespread protests for months. Indian forces responded with force, using pellet guns that caused serious injuries. Dozens, including security forces, died. Pakistan, a strong supporter of Kashmir's separatist struggle, intensified efforts to raise the issue of human rights violations on international forums. In response, the Modi administration started raising the issue of human rights violations by Pakistan's security forces in its restive Balochistan province. By doing so, they crossed a red line their predecessors had avoided. Tensions mounted. In late September, 4 gunmen attacked an Indian military base in Uri in Kashmir. 18 Indian soldiers died. India blamed the attack on Pakistan-based militant groups. Modi promised to work to isolate Pakistan internationally. The same week, Pakistan Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif blasted India in his speech to the United Nations General Assembly.
This indigenous uprising of the Kashmiris have been met as usual with brutal repression by India's occupation force of over 500,000 soldiers. Over 100 Kashmiris have been killed, hundreds including children and infants blinded by shotgun pellets, and over 6,000 unarmed civilians injured over the past 2 months.
India reacted sharply. Its Minister for External Affairs, Sushma Swaraj, called Pakistan a supporter and exporter of terrorism.
In our midst, there are nations that still speak the language of terrorism, that nurture it, peddle it, and export it. To shelter terrorists has become their calling card.
Soon after, India claimed it carried out surgical strikes against militants on the Pakistani side of Kashmir's border. Pakistan rejected the claim but warned that such an incursion would be considered an act of war. Continued skirmishes along the line of control, the de facto border in Kashmir, have killed dozens, mostly civilians. Pakistan's army conducted a military drill near the Indian border to flex its muscle. Meanwhile, India lobbied for countries to drop out of a regional summit to be held in Islamabad. Pakistan was forced to postpone the gathering. While the two nuclear-armed neighbors continue to trade jibes, many are hoping cooler heads prevail in the coming year. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
Be sure to visit our website, voanews.com, for more on the stories that you've heard on our program and more that you haven't. Follow us on Twitter as well at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, check out our Facebook page. It's VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Last week, an interesting and somewhat mysterious intersection of entertainment and politics took place in New York. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins us with more.
I just want to take you out and show you off. You already know that you're the perfect one.
On Tuesday morning, Kanye West just materialized at Trump Tower in Manhattan, and he went on in and he had a sit-down meeting with Donald Trump. Lasted about 15 minutes. This was, I think, by far the biggest news story of the week, but it's also one of the most mysterious because the meeting was held behind closed doors, and neither one went into a great deal of detail about what was said. Trump said, we talked about life, and he also mentioned that he and Kanye have been friends for some time. Trump spokeswoman Hope Hicks said Kanye West requested the meeting, and they were happy to accommodate him. Kanye finished the meeting by giving Trump a book of art.
Kanye West, obviously very interested in a lot of social issues as he is face-to-face with this, if you will, and dealing with his audience and just being a performer.
Engaging with audiences. He's very political. Later Tuesday on Twitter said that he wanted to meet Trump to discuss multicultural issues, including bullying, supporting teachers, modernizing curriculums, and violence in his hometown of Chicago. Kanye says it's important to have a direct line of communication with the president to effect real change. It's worth noting that Kanye's mother, Donda West, was a teacher. She chaired the English department at Chicago State University before retiring to become Kanye's manager. She died in 2007, and it hit Kanye West very hard. A lot of people speculate that that has been a contributing factor to his mental state over the past few years. Kanye West was, in fact, hospitalized in Los Angeles last month for what first responder dispatchers said was a psychiatric emergency. Now, again, we don't know a great deal about his hospitalization. We know he has canceled all his tour dates for the rest of the year. We also don't know if Kanye West is going to perform at Donald Trump's inauguration on January 20th, and we certainly don't know if he was offered any sort of position in the Trump administration. Again, a compelling but mysterious news story. He has, in fact, spoken about running for president in 2020. We don't know the seriousness of these claims, but who knows?
Who knows? And who knows what topics they discussed? I mean, maybe they did get into some heady things like climate change and the economy.
They may have covered a lot of ground in those 15 minutes. Kanye said he was in New York exploring some possible places to live, which has fueled speculation that there may be a breakup between Kanye and his wife, Kim Kardashian. Kim will most likely stay in Los Angeles. But this is pure speculation, and there have also been reports that the marriage is solid.
We'll see how it all shakes out in 2017. Counting it all down each and every week is Ray McDonald on our Top 20 Countdown. That's on VOA 1, and you can also catch Ray on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
Thank you, Jim.
That's all the time we have for International Edition. You can find more of us at our website, voanews.com. More is good. Like us on Facebook, too, at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Throughout this holiday season, the United States government is profiling the cases of prisoners unjustly held around the world and the families they leave behind. The campaign is sponsored by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, and is known as #FreeToBeHome Political Prisoner Campaign. The stories of these individuals highlight the broader struggle faced by so many families of political prisoners who have to commemorate countless family occasions with loved ones behind bars. One such individual is Ukrainian film director Oleg Sentsov, who was arrested in Crimea in 2014, shortly after Russia's occupation of the peninsula, in retaliation for his vocal opposition to the occupation. In 2015, a Russian court convicted him and a fellow activist, Alexander Kolchenko, of plotting terrorist attacks in Crimea in a trial that Amnesty International described as redolent of Stalinist-era show trials. Heather McGill, a researcher at Amnesty International, went on to say, "This trial was fatally flawed and credible allegations of torture and other ill treatment have been ignored by the court." Sentsov was given a 20-year sentence and is incarcerated in a penal colony in the Siberian region of Yakutia, about 3,500 miles from Ukraine's capital, Kiev. He has not seen his two young children or wife since. His co-defendant, Kolchenko, received a 10-year sentence. At least 10 Ukrainians are serving long jail sentences in Russia following dubious trials. Others are in captivity in separatist-run eastern Ukraine or in occupied Crimea. In a letter from Sentsov, smuggled out of prison in September, he wrote, "There are many of us held in Russia, and even more in Donbass. Some have been freed, others hope and wait." Sentsov was detained for exercising his universal rights. He represents thousands of other prisoners unjustly detained around the world. The United States, said Ambassador Power, calls on all governments, including Russia, to release their political prisoners. Political prisoners should be free to believe. They should be free to be loved. They should be free to be home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.